This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. As 2014 draws to a close, it's time once again to look back at the advances we've made in understanding our world. One thing I can tell you, summing up the year in science is never boring. This year, we saw the discovery of some of the largest known dinosaurs, a supersized cousin of Tyrannosaurus rex, and a plant eater so large it would have had nothing to fear from T-Rex. Seriously, they named it Dreadnoughtus, fears nothing. Researchers also probed the origins of the human race and rewrote some of that story, while others expanded the repertoire of life's building blocks by adding two new synthetic bases to the DNA of E. coli bacteria. You can find links to our favorite year-in-review web posts from a variety of science news outlets on our website, capeandislands.org. They've got more information on all of those stories. Today, we're focusing our attention on two areas of global importance with some local ties. I'm talking about ocean science and space exploration. Call it 2014, the Final Frontiers version. And yes, New England really does have ties to space exploration. More on that later. Joining me to discuss some of the top ocean and space science stories of 2014 is Dr. Michael West, Director of Astronomy at the Mariah Mitchell Association on Nantucket, and Dr. Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. It's good to have you both back. Michael West, I have one word for you. Rosetta.
Yeah, that's a good one.
This mission to land on a comet has topped just about every top 10 science list that I have seen so far. It has captured public attention like few things have this year. What is it about this mission that is so important and so special?
Well, I think it's a number of things, Heather. I think, yes, this is the first time that a spacecraft has ever gone into orbit around a comet. It's the first time that it's actually sent a little robot to land on the comet. So that was a first, and I think that got a lot of public attention. But I think a lot of it comes back to who we are, right? I mean, the real mission of Rosetta was to study this comet to see if comets might have brought water to the Earth's oceans in the past. So it's trying to understand, you know, here on Nantucket, we're surrounded by water around the Cape, and understand where did that water come from and whether comets might have been the vehicles that, you know, brought water to our planet. And so for many people, I think there's a kind of personal connection in that sense.
Now, there was a little bit of a hitch with the landing of Philae, the actual lander that Rosetta sent down to the comet. How much of what scientists wanted to learn have we actually been able to learn from this mission? How successful has it been?
Well, the European Space Agency says that despite things not going as planned, they've still been able to accomplish a good 90% of their mission. You know, for example, maybe we'll talk more about this later, but, you know, Rosetta or the Philae lander is able to drill samples and has been able to actually measure the ratio of different types of hydrogen atoms, if you will, in the water that makes up the comet, and to find that it's different from the same ratio of different types of hydrogen atoms that we find here on Earth suggests that comets may not be the origin of the Earth's oceans. And so that is a really big result, of course, and that was kind of the major goal. So arguably, Rosetta's already accomplished its main mission, and okay, it ended up it landed awkwardly, shall we say, on this comet, and its batteries are sort of drained at the moment, but it still did most of what it set out to do. It's a huge accomplishment.
Susan Avery, researchers at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution were actually involved in research here on Earth, but looking at a specific kind of meteorite, again, trying to address this same question of whether or not these very early formed meteorites might have been the source of the Earth's oceans.
This is a joint program student, Sarfian. He measured basically the hydrogen isotope composition of water within meteorites, and basically said that, well, perhaps this is meteorites might be the result or the origin of water. He basically looked at the asteroid Vesta, and the question is, do you see the same type of mineral content, hydrogen, deuterium mineral content on these meteorites as you do on Earth? And so his is in agreement because he shows that he's got a data point that's sort of the first to provide this kind of age constraint. Previously, age constraints only came from models of the formation of the
ocean. So we didn't actually have data. It was just kind of a computer model.
Just a computer model. Yeah.
Educated guess.
Educated guess. Yeah. So you have both the Rosetta and then this Vesta work coming together very nicely this year to kind of give us new insights on the time and aging, basically the two big questions: where the water on Earth originally came from and when that was acquired.
I mean, so if this both of these pieces of information are coming together to say that, in fact, it looks like water was present on Earth from the very beginning as it was forming, didn't come from these later impacts, doesn't seem to match, you know, what Rosetta found or Philae found on a comet, doesn't found what was found in these, and I have to say it, these carbonaceous chondrites.
Yes.
I had to practice it and then decided I loved saying it. This one specific kind of meteorite. I mean, what does that mean? Michael West, does that make these bodies in space less interesting if they're not the source of our oceans? Perhaps not. Does that mean they're maybe not the source of some of the building blocks of life, as they've also been thought to be?
No, I don't think so. I mean, like most things in science, we have to be a little bit cautious, right? I mean, there's always been this assumption that, you know, whatever water might have been on the primitive Earth couldn't have survived, and so it had to come later from other bodies, whether those are comets or asteroids. And so certainly the work that's been done at Woods Hole suggests that, you know, maybe the oceans have been here for a long time. You know, a caveat to throw in all of that is that a lot of these carbonaceous chondrite meteorites, they're fragments of the asteroid Vesta, but they've been sitting on Earth for a while, and so they can actually absorb a significant amount of Earth water as well while they've been here. So that just it becomes complicated. But the other thing, too, is, you know, with Rosetta, it's ruled out one particular type of comet that probably couldn't have brought water to Earth. But there are different families of comets in the solar system at different locations from the sun. And so it's possible that some of those other ones might have been the main deliverers. Also, asteroids are still another possibility. There's a Japanese craft called Hayabusa 2 that's actually going to land on an asteroid in 2020 and also probe it for water content and hydrogen isotope ratios and things like that. So I think, like most things in science, right, you have to be conservative, and I think it's still a lot of it's an open question, to be honest.
Now, Michael, there were another couple of discoveries this year that involved water. Water was found, or evidence of water, trapped inside a rock on Mars, and then a large body of water potentially under the ice on Saturn's moon Enceladus. So what's the significance of those findings?
Well, I mean, those are really interesting because there's always been this thought, if you're going to look for life in the solar system, where would you look? And Mars has been, you know, the sort of obvious choice. And I mean, even in the last 24 hours, there's quite an exciting development where the Curiosity rover has detected a burst of methane. Last year, the Curiosity said, oh, we didn't find any methane. And methane is a telltale signature, perhaps, of life. It's the outgassing of waste products, essentially. And Curiosity last year said, well, we don't find any. But now the same rover craft detected a burst of methane that lasted about 2 months. And so the idea is that could there be primitive microbes on Mars? And that's what we're detecting now. Methane can't last very long. Excuse me. And so it has to have been produced relatively recently. And also the Curiosity rover found organic molecules in Martian rocks for the first time. And again, organic doesn't mean living, but it's the building blocks of life. So could Mars have had all the ingredients for life to exist? Beyond Mars, of course, there are some moons in the solar system, like Titan, like Enceladus, like Europa, where there's pretty clear evidence that there's liquids, maybe liquid water in some cases or other types of liquids. And so, you know, looking at life on Earth, where there's water, there seems to be life. And so if we find similar environments elsewhere in the solar system, those become the most likely places to look and explore in the hopes of finding life out there as well.
Susan Avery, the ocean science community seemed to get pretty revved up by the announcement of this body of water under the ice on Saturn's moon. I think, in fact, I first encountered it from tweets that came from ocean scientists, not from space scientists. Do you think it's just kind of an excitement about the possibility of commonality with other places in the solar system, that there could be an ocean, that there could be the building blocks of life elsewhere?
Well, I think that's exactly what science is all about, that curiosity. And when you see that we, you know, space and ocean exploration have definitely a lot in common. And you see the extreme environments in both cases. You see life on here and question whether life is going to be elsewhere. And you're right, water is one of those important building blocks. So, you know, the idea that the mystery that there might have been, that there might be some water either on Mars or Saturn definitely does pique the ocean science interests.
In case you're just joining us, we're looking back at some of the biggest developments in ocean and space science in 2014. My guests are Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Michael West, Director of Astronomy at the Mariah Mitchell Association on Nantucket. Michael West, the other big name in space exploration this year besides Rosetta was Orion, of course. This is the space capsule that's supposed to take people to Mars eventually. Saw the first test launch just a few weeks ago. Here's what it sounded like at Mission Control in Cape Canaveral when Orion left the launch pad.
And liftoff at dawn. The dawn of Orion and a new era of American space exploration.
Michael West, how critical was this launch of Orion and what have we learned from it?
Oh, well, it was huge, right? I mean, humans haven't left low Earth orbit since 1972, right? And so this was, you know, humanity's first attempt to get back into space, in a sense. And ultimately, it's the Orion craft that's going to bring astronauts to Mars in the future. So NASA built this craft. It hadn't been tested before. And it, you know, no pun intended, it flew with flying colors. It's different from the previous Apollo capsules, for example, because this one will hold four astronauts. It will go much, much further into space. So this one, for example, went 15 times further into space than the International Space Station is, right? And we're so used to us going to the space station. Well, this went 15 times further. The reason they did this was so that it could then re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at a really high speed, as if it was returning from the moon. It went almost 4,000 miles out into space, and that was to test the heat shields and the computers and other components of the spacecraft just to make sure it could survive this kind of journey without any people on board first, of course. So it's really the first step back into a deep space exploration. In 2018, it's supposed to go on an orbit around the moon. And, you know, NASA, for example, Congress just approved actually 10% more money for this project than NASA had even asked. Right, and NASA's been struggling to do this kind of with a, you know, dwindling budget over the years, but it was such a great success that Congress has actually given NASA money, more money than it asked for, to keep this mission going.
Well, we will talk more about the money required and the benefits of human space exploration in a little while, but as you mentioned, one of the critical systems that was being tested during this first launch was the heat shield, which, as it turns out, was manufactured right here in Massachusetts by Textron Systems. Jim Thibodeau is the heat shield expert for Textron, and I spoke to him by phone recently. How different is the heat shield for a capsule like Orion, which is more like the Apollo capsule was, than the kind of chunks of foam for the space shuttle? How different is it?
The mission itself is very different, and that's why the materials are different. The Orion's flights are going to be up around the moon or to asteroids or whatever. Their return velocities are going to be similar to what the EFT flight test was, even high, 20,000 miles an hour, 22,000 miles an hour. And those will generate heats, temperatures from, 4,000 degrees to maybe over 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So those types of temperatures with a tile that is used on the space shuttle would not work.
Can I ask kind of a silly question?
Sure. No silly questions.
What kind of paint do you use on something that is going to be coming back through the atmosphere at 25,000 miles per hour, as you said, almost 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit?
The paint on the surface in the end, is that what you're talking about? White paint?
Right, the white paint on the outside of the whole thing.
Well, that almost immediately burns off when it hits the atmosphere. So that really doesn't have any role in the thermal properties. What that really does is that helps to reflect the heat when it's exposed, in space.
Now, as I understand it, this was the largest, or is, I should say, the largest single heat shield that has ever been built, 16.5 feet in diameter. What kind of changes or modifications and challenges does that present?
The challenge it presented from Apollo, which was, around 14 feet in diameter, maybe a little smaller than that, was that when you apply the Avcoat material, it goes through this gunning process. You apply this honeycomb material, and then you fill all these cells with these guns. So individually, these cells are filled.
And am I correct that that has to be done by hand? Is there no robotic way to fill each of those little honeycombs?
Well, we actually did try robotic. We got as far as having a vision robot actually dispensing the material on a flat panel, But, you know, the investment, I think, got to be a little too large, and then the time constraint, you know, the heat shield was ready to be built, and so they kind of put that on hold. So we did look at that, and it is possible, but you have to look at the trade-off as to, you know, the development costs of doing all that those robots, and then how many times are you going to build a heat shield. So at this point, they decided to go with the manual. And so to get back to your original question, there is a time constraint on the material. It can only be exposed for so long before it has to go in for its first cure. So in other words, you can't completely gun 330,000 cells in one cycle. You just can't get that many people physically around the 16.5-foot heat shield and do their process. So we actually did it in four pieces. So going through those cycles and curing it and then, you know, doing the next cycle and the next cycle, that was, you know, that was a bit of a load to do and very time-consuming.
You're very modest to say that was a bit of a challenge and a bit time-consuming. 330,000 honeycombs.
So 8 months was a pretty long time to do a heat shield.
Apollo was 40 years ago. How much digging did you have to do to recover institutional memory and protocols and, you know, all the things that went into designing it the first time around to then start the redesign process for Apollo?
There was quite a bit of that because I venture to say there was not the clean documentation that one would have today. You know, today everything is on computers and things are backed up. Back then everything was on paper. So we had a pretty big task to go back and look up all those specifications and processes and try to recreate, you know, exactly when you get down to the details of what they did for that process. And so what we did is we contacted what we called the graybeards, and that were, you know, guys and gals that actually worked on the Apollo program that were still around in the local area, and we brought a bunch of them over to Textron Systems in Wilmington. And just try to gain from them as much as they could remember or have them point to whatever information that was available. So that was it was quite a project to try to recreate and get as much documentation so that as we went down this road of reestablishing this product of those specifications, it would be easy. So there was a lot of that.
Heat shield problems plagued the final years of the space shuttle program. How nervous were you on the morning of December 5th as Orion headed into space for the first time with your heat shield on it?
Not at all. I was pretty confident because of the, you know, we have a great crew here at Textron Systems that took a lot of care in building this heat shield. And you know, we go through a lot of quality steps to check that each process is correct. We actually go in and x-ray each of the 330,000 cells, and if we see anything that's abnormal, any foreign material in there, any voids in there, we physically go in, remove that material from that cell, regun that cell, recure it, and then x-ray it again to make sure it's okay. So the scrutiny that heat shield has gone through, you know, in that 8 month fabrication period, you know, I was very confident that there wouldn't be any issues at all after you live through something like that.
Clearly, it was successful. The launch was successful, and the vehicle returned in one piece. So successful to that degree. Do we know now fully how well the heat shield performed, or how long will it be before we have that information?
There were some inspections when they pulled the heat shield into San Diego, into port. So what we have at this point is really data based on visual inspections, and all that feedback that I'm getting from NASA from those inspections is the heat shield looks exactly the way it was planned to be.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah. Now, there's a ton of thermal data. We had a lot of instruments, you know, located in this heat shield because it's the first one out there. So, you know, it'll probably take them a while before they take all the data from those, but that'll just give them some characterization data so that maybe we can make the heat shield a little thinner and save some weight, possibly things of that nature. But at this point, you know, it worked as advertised.
Well, Jim Tabato, thank you so much for your time.
All righty.
That was Jim Tabato of Textron Systems, the company that manufactured the heat shield for NASA's new Orion space capsule. Also in the studio with me today, Susan Avery, president and director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and joining us by phone from Nantucket, Michael West, director of astronomy at the Mariah Mitchell Association. We will talk more about the highlights of ocean and space exploration in 2014 after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Susan Avery, president and director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Michael West, director of astronomy at the Mariah Mitchell Association, join me today to recap some of the highlights of 2014 in space and ocean science. Michael West, how soon could we conceivably see people on Mars?
Well, I think the current estimate is sort of the early 2030s or something. But there's still a lot of things that have to come together before that, right? There's just, you know, it's a long way to send people, obviously. And, you know, there's lots of issues that have to be dealt with. I was in Houston at the NASA Space Johnson Space Center for the launch of Orion, and I got to talk with some of the astronauts and some of the nutritionists there. There's a whole host of things to be worked out. You need to bring about 12,000 pounds of food per astronaut, for example. So,
wow.
You know, it's to survive, you know, these long journeys. So the earliest I think anybody thinks is, you know, it's a good sort of two decades away.
Someone asked me at one point how long it would take to get astronauts to Mars, and the only response I could muster was far longer than I would want to spend in the Orion capsule.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's pretty tiny. I got to climb inside a Mach 1 when I was there, and it's not a lot of room, that's for sure.
Now, just this first launch of Orion cost an estimated, this is NASA's numbers, $377 million just for this one launch. NASA is spending something on the order of $8 billion per year on human exploration. From a science perspective, in terms of what we would actually gain in terms of new knowledge, is this really worth the money?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think if you, you know, asked a bunch of different scientists, you'd probably get quite varied answers, of course. I mean, my own personal sense is that the scientific return on sort of human-powered missions is pretty minimal. I mean, if you look, for example, the Rosetta mission that just landed on this comet, that cost about $1 billion, right? $1 billion is also the price tag of building the world's biggest telescope at the moment. There are several being constructed around the world. Whereas the estimated cost to send a human mission to Mars, I mean, nobody knows for sure at the moment, but the estimates range from about $6 billion to $500 billion. So it's just hugely expensive. And the scientific return is pretty minimal, right? I mean, look, the Curiosity rover just thinks it might have found the best evidence yet for life on Mars. That's pretty exciting. It's a little robot craft crawling along the surface of the planet. But there's also that motivational component of it, right? I mean, you know, the number of tweets and everything that was going on around the world during the Orion launch was just staggering. And there's something about it that captures human imagination. And so I think that's the sort of less tangible benefit of human space exploration. But certainly from a pure science perspective, I personally think you can do a lot of it much more cost-effectively with just robot craft.
This is a perennial tug of war in both space science and ocean science, or I guess exploration, not just research. This, you know, the competing benefits of putting people in these remote locations directly versus putting robots there that might be able to gather the information. And you know, I spoke with someone earlier this year who's been very seriously looking at the possibilities of creating artificial intelligence, robots that might even have morals and the ability to make value judgments. Is there an intersection between that robotics community and the space or ocean communities? Could we make these? I mean, when we're talking about robots right now, we're basically talking about vehicles that are carrying scientific instruments. But is there a possibility that we could send intelligent robots in place of humans sometime in the near future into space or into the ocean?
It's possible, of course. There are always, you know, one of the questions has been about exploring the universe. You know, why isn't Earth swarming with aliens? And there's always been this concept of what they call von Neumann machines, and the idea that perhaps an advanced civilization, maybe us someday too, could make self-replicating robots or intelligent robots that can go do a lot of these things without the perils, of course, of sending a flesh and blood human. So I think it's possible, but I think it's probably still quite a ways down the way. And it's always a question of how much people relate to a quasi-human or a robot, right? Though it was very interesting, I thought, when the Philae lander ran out of batteries and sort of seemed to almost, you know, die or go into hibernation on the comet, it was interesting the reaction you'd see, like on social media. People almost felt as if they'd developed some kind of personal bond with this little, you know, little spacecraft that could. And so it was nice to see that. So maybe there is a lot of room for this in the future, but I think there's still a lot of details to be worked out, of course.
We see that same sort of personality and sentimental attachment to ocean vehicles as well. And the first one that pops to mind, of course, is Alvin, possibly the most known ocean vehicle of any of them. And this year was Alvin's 50th birthday, a big event.
It was, and we really did have fun celebrating Alvin's 50th, as well as many people around the country. If you go to our website, you can see those birthday greetings that were sent. I particularly enjoyed the one that actually analyzed Alvin's DNA and RNA, which I thought was wonderful. But, you know, it does bring up this relationship between robotics and human exploration of the ocean. And at this stage for science, we still do need both. So Alvin has had its major upgrade this year. It's been in the water. It's done some great new science, and everyone's really pretty excited about this.
Well, in addition to this upgrade of Alvin, we're seeing a lot of turnover and modernization in the whole fleet of vessels, whether they're the large-scale ships or the robotic vessels or the human-occupied submersibles in the ocean research fleet. Of course, Woods Hole being a hub of all this, the docks here in Woods Hole this year have seen a steady stream of anniversaries, new ships, new vehicles, some retirements. And I want to play a little highlight reel that we put together, starting with Alvin's 50th.
1, 2, 3. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Alvin. Happy birthday to you.
My name is Jason Williams. I'm a mechanical engineer and a pilot for ROV called Ropos. I'm from Victoria, BC, Canada.
You know, you hear the story, there's 100 words for snow, 100 words for ice. This is true. Sikulyak means first year sea ice that is safe enough for man to walk on, which is literally the type of ice that we can work in.
Susan Avery, another thing we just heard in that little montage of audio clips was some sound from the arrival of the research vessel Sikulyak in Woods Hole. Now, this is not a new vessel for Woods Hole's fleet specifically, but because this is such a flagship port, this new vessel stopped through, and it's the first ice-capable research vessel that's really dedicated to research. I mean, researchers before have had to essentially rent space on Coast Guard vessels, so given how much, you know, warming we're seeing in the Arctic, how important is this ship, and how long have we been waiting for it to come online?
Well, I think it's a very important new ship to the fleet of research vessels that scientists have access to. As you mentioned, Heather, the Arctic is just melting at an accelerated rate, and it's relatively unexplored in terms of its biology, what's happening underwater, what's happening on the surface, how the physics and chemistry, what kind of minerals, what kind of oil. So it's really important for scientists to get up there to really answer some of the big scientific questions and explore what's underneath all of that ice that's now going to be accessible.
Now, we've seen, as we mentioned, a number of turnovers in the fleet this year. That's one of the additions. In the coming year, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution will be taking over operation of the flagship of a whole new class of research vessels called the Neil Armstrong, a wonderful tie-in with space exploration there. Kind of seems like a tit for tat.
Yes.
All the space shuttles were named after great ocean vessels. Now we've got an ocean research vessel named after an astronaut. But in general, the trend is that the fleet is shrinking. We've got fewer boats, and the new boats that are coming online are largely smaller and more focused on robotics than on getting humans out to sea. Is the ocean science community, you know, moving directly opposite of the space science community and headed towards more robotic exploration?
I think that yes, I think part of that is true. You're seeing the explosion, if you will, of robotics and robotic sensors, new sensors, and the ability to put tools, sensors, platforms in the ocean for long periods of time, and to get new data that you just haven't been able to get with just working off of a ship. That's not to say that ships aren't going to be extremely important. They will really be a mainstay of research and getting into the ocean. But augmenting that with observatories, with robotic systems, and the ability to throw things over the side of a ship and let it go and go have the ship go do someplace, go somewhere else, do some work, and then come back and pick up a robotic instrument is really some of the new ways that we're going to get in access to the sea. The new ships also are environmentally more friendly. They will have endurance efforts, but it is shrinking in size. And part of that's due to the fact that we're going into more robotic realms, but also part of it is resources. Ships are expensive, and the ability to get into the ocean with limited federal funding is what's holding us back.
Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is right at the center of a lot of this explosion of robotics, a center for marine robotics, and in fact just got a state grant to help build a test facility. I mean, the state of Massachusetts really looking at marine robotics as kind of an economic driver, an important economic sector within the state.
Yes, we're really very excited about this. This is part of our new Center for Marine Robotics, and we have received from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the Mass Technology Collaborative, a $5 million gift. And this is really going to, or grant, if you will, and this is going to be used for rapid prototyping and test and evaluation facilities that will accelerate basically the ideas of robotics from the back of the envelope to into the ocean.
Michael West, you were talking about, the relative scientific versus inspirational or aspirational values of human versus robotic space exploration. I mean, we saw, the space race in the 60s really all about getting humans into space, and then we kind of backed off from that. We had the space station, but really an explosion in robotic exploration, now going back towards human exploration, perhaps as a focus. I mean, do you think this is just kind of a natural ebb and flow of where the focus is in space exploration?
Perhaps. I think there'll always be challenges. I mean, we're talking now about sending humans to Mars, which is, just the next planet out from the sun, right? At the moment, we've got a spacecraft that's arriving at Pluto, and it's going to give us our first up-close look of this, dwarf planet, if you will. The possibility of ever sending a human that far, for example, is still so far into the future. So we can send humans out to a certain distance, and that's great. But I think as we're driven to sort of explore further into our solar system or even beyond eventually, I think we'll still be somewhat limited by the ability to send humans. So I do think, as you say, Heather, there is a sort of ebb and flow over time. And, many people have said, look, it's 4 decades since we sent a human to the moon, right? And I think a lot of people really miss that. But I think, when it comes down, as NASA's budget and space exploration budget has been tightened over the years, I think it's just trying to get the maximum bang for the buck. And so that's resulted in more of this reliance on robotic craft. NASA's been outsourcing a lot of its, even the rides to the space station. So I think NASA's realized, hey, maybe they don't have to shoulder all the costs themselves. There's other people that might be willing to participate.
Susan Avery, I want to get your take on this kind of ebb and flow when we're looking at ocean science and the current explosion in robotics. Is ocean science just at a different point in this back and forth between human and robotic, or are there different drivers? Is there a different reason why it might be more important to have humans on the seafloor?
Yeah, I think that a human presence in the seafloor allows you to do is make a decision. The human has that capacity to observe, perceive, integrate, and say, oh, I want to go over to this part of the ocean. It looks interesting, and not this part right now. And I think distinguishing that environmental awareness from a robot point of view is still in its infancy stage. I mean, we do have robots that are that we're working on environmental awareness for an autonomous car. So where the machine can make a decision in real quickly to say, oh, yes, this is where I need to go. We're not quite that there in terms of ocean exploration, where you have that basically back to your machine intelligence,
right,
that we don't have all of the sensors that are integrating all this data around them and realizing that and making being able to make a decision to say, I have to go over here and not over there. That said, we use robotics and human occupied vehicles in concert. And often we'll do a robotic, if you're looking at a first part of a new part of the ocean, you often will use a robotic instrument to do a survey, mowing the lawn back and forth and getting data back so that you can then narrow where you would like to take a human occupied vehicle to do further exploration.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. In the studio with me today, Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and on the phone from Nantucket, Michael West, Director of Astronomy at the Mariah Mitchell Association. More after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We are looking back at the year in review, some of the biggest trends and developments in ocean and space science in 2014. With me is Michael West, Director of Astronomy at the Mariah Mitchell Association, and Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Michael West, you mentioned right before the break this increasing privatization of space exploration. I think we saw something pretty interesting with the Orion launch, where not only outsourcing the building of the vehicle, which has been a feature of previous missions, but actually sharing mission control with Lockheed Martin. But then we also saw some really high-profile failures of commercial or private launches this year. What, if anything, does that mean to the prospects for private spaceflight?
I'm not sure, Heather. I mean, in the sense that, you know, NASA's budget has been so limited for a while, so they're have pretty tight constraints on what they can do by themselves. So it's partly out of necessity, I think, turning towards more privatization. But, you know, it's sad that whenever there's a mishap, of course, you know, the Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 broke up over the Mojave Desert, and the Antares rocket from Orbital Sciences, you know, blew up on launch. And, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment were destroyed. So these things happen, of course, but I think, you know, it's like if you look at any early days of exploration, whether it was, you know, the first, you know, the Wright brothers trying to fly, there's always mishaps, and sadly they come with a human cost sometimes. But I don't think anybody thinks that this is not the way to go at this point. I mean, with the Antares rocket, for example, the issues focused on the fact that they were using, you know, vintage 1960 Soviet engines, and maybe that's the issue. And there has to be commercially viable for these companies to want to continue going. But, you know, things like SpaceX and all these other programs, there certainly seems to be enough interest, and NASA's more than happy to have people contribute in that way.
Susan Avery, we've also seen a number of stories over the past year about private research vessels. I mean, last year, 2013, we had James Cameron's dive to the deepest point in the ocean, clearly a private endeavor, not part of the academic or government-funded research community. We're also seeing entire research ships that are being run by private entities. How is that changing the way that ocean research is conducted?
Well, I think that it opens up other opportunities for access to, you know, two-thirds of the planet. These private philanthropists who have provided this access, it does enable additional science. That said, it's not a replacement for loss of federal funding that we've seen in the ocean sciences and across the sciences in general, because, you know, they have very specific ideas of what they would like to, these philanthropists would like to work on. But they have really added opportunities to get to parts of the ocean that normally the university fleet, research fleet may not go to. It provides other opportunities to work in partnership with some of these people who are generously donating the resources to the field.
This time last year, we were talking about the immense amount of research effort going into understanding the role of microbes, both within the human body, within the ocean, at the surface, at the deep ocean. Microbes seem to be everywhere. This year, if I had to pick, I'd have to say an unlikely organism of the year, it would have to be deep sea and cold water corals. There just seemed to be this immense interest, this welling up of interest. There were multiple cruises to go look at cold water and deep sea corals. what is all of the excitement and interest about?
Well, deep sea corals, they're very diverse, and they're a valuable resource that provide important habitat structure for fishes and invertebrates. And they're also of conservation concern because deep sea corals have slow growth rates, meaning they take a very long time to recover from damage to bottom disturbance like fishing or like the deep water horizon.
Well, and
even.
I think that's the first time that they kind of entered the public consciousness on any large scale was we started hearing, well, there's been damage to these deep cold water corals from the Gulf oil spill. So where does that stand?
The deep sea corals have been looked at, and it's there is damage, but it's not as extensive that we perhaps originally thought it would be in some of these deep sea corals.
Well, we did get an update on just where a lot of the oil from the Gulf oil spill may have ended up, in part kind of, you know, pointed a little bit more of a finger at that oil spill in potentially damaging the corals because scientists found a bunch of oil in those same areas where we found the damaged corals and, in fact, called it like a bathtub ring of oil left around the Gulf. I mean, how surprising was this?
Well, I don't know. It's the first time we've actually seen it, right? So as many things in the ocean. I think what's also surprising is the amount that has basically sunk into the sediments and into the deep coral regions, but also on the other side, how much on the coastal areas in the shallower areas that the oil has degraded so rapidly. So we have sort of two new, this deep water horizon basically has opened our eyes to these important coral reef systems as well as coastal ecosystems and how they can recover and how they degrade.
Well, as you said, it's really quite expensive to get out into the ocean, figure out what the impact of events like the Gulf oil spill or Fukushima really is.
Yep.
It's especially hard to get funding to keep following these events for years and years, which is what all of the scientists say we need to be doing. And this year we saw Ken Bissler at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, one of the leading people following the Fukushima nuclear disaster from the time it first happened. He's been, you know, making forays into all sorts of alternative funding from the beginning. This year really took the leap and went all the way to crowdfunding and crowdsourcing his research to follow up on Fukushima.
He did. And this is another example of how we're being creative, if you will, or how scientists are being creative in finding new ways of getting funding. There is no U.S. federal agency that's currently funding the monitoring of the ocean for radioactivity. And so Ken really wanted to look at what was happening along the West Coast. There was a lot of concern of the public about cesium approaching the West Coast and what would be what could they expect. And so Ken used this crowdsource funding, and he's been very successful. Let's see if I can find some of the numbers here. He's launched the program. Individual groups have collected more than 50 seawater samples that have been returned to Ken, who has analyzed them. All of the results are up on our website. And all the basically the coastal samples that have been tested have shown no sign of cesium-134 from Fukushima, or at least it's below the detectable levels of the analysis.
So that's reassuring news.
It's reassuring news, yes.
Now, we had some not-so-reassuring news. We, of course, passed the landmark of 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere back this summer, the highest that it has been in millions of years. And we're learning more and more about the role that the ocean is playing, for one, potentially in what's been caused called the pause in warming, that we're not seeing air temperatures rising as quickly, but we're learning that a lot of that heat might be going into the ocean. I mean, how concerned are ocean scientists about what we're learning about the extent of the warming in the ocean?
Well, I think climate scientists in general, both atmosphere and ocean scientists, are concerned. I think that there were two hallmark measurements this year that made me really concerned. And one of you already mentioned the 400 parts per million passage of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And then the evidence that we're beginning to see now of the heating of the deeper parts of the ocean. You remember that when you look at global surface temperature measurements, they don't really look at what's happening below the surface of the ocean. And so when you start seeing this major heating at lower depths, that raises concern. Now, why is that a concern? Well, that excess heating, as you said, the excess energy associated with the excess carbon dioxide that we are putting in the atmosphere, 93% of that excess energy or heat is in the ocean. Okay, not in the atmosphere. So the atmosphere heating and the land heating and the ice heating are very, very small compared to how much heat the ocean can basically hold. And as that heating occurs, it's going to come down and warm up deeper levels of the ocean. And once you do that, the long residence times of that heat in the ocean means that you're stretching out, if you will, the residence of that heat.
That'll come back to heat the air at some point. And of course has impacts on the organisms living in the ocean, the whole ecosystem of the ocean.
Exactly. And it also affects the ocean atmosphere coupling, which drives a lot of our climate systems, our wind systems, both in the ocean and in the atmosphere.
Michael West, I want to end with a story that as it was happening, people were talking Nobel Prize. It was a candidate to top even Rosetta for the top breakthrough of the year. And then it kind of fell apart. And I'm talking here about Bicep 2 and the idea that scientists might have caught a glimpse, the earliest glimpse of what happened right after the Big Bang. So what did they think they had found and what happened?
Well, after the Big Bang, Heather, the universe even today is filled with the afterglow, this explosive birth of our universe. And there's always been this theory that the universe underwent a really rapid exponential expansion of space for a brief instant after the Big Bang, and that if that had happened, it would imprint a recognizable pattern on this cosmic afterglow that fills space. And so the Bicep 2 experiment said, aha, we think we found it. And it opens up all sorts of interesting possibilities. It seemed to confirm that maybe inflation really did happen, this rapid expansion of the universe, and that there might be the possibility of multiverses or multiple universes people talked about. So there's a lot of excitement about that. The problem was that this signal that they were trying to detect is really, really weak. It's really hard to see, and there's other potential sources of contamination that can masquerade as the same effect. And so the Bicep 2 team was really careful. They tried to do all the corrections they could. For example, the main source of, or the most likely source of contamination, which now seems to have been the case actually, is you can get a similar pattern visible in this cosmic afterglow from dust in our own Milky Way galaxy. The dust gets warm and it re-radiates. And so the Bicep 2 team tried to correct for that and tried to make sure that they'd taken account of all these possible errors. And, you know, their paper that they published was quite clear about this. But in the end, it looks like they were, at least the current believing is they were probably wrong, that in fact what they did detect was most likely this signal of dust in our own Milky Way galaxy. It was just masquerading as evidence of cosmic inflation, this rapid expansion. And so, you know, I mean, it's how science works, right? I mean, you know, you follow something, you get all excited, you think you've got some evidence, but then another study comes along and says, you know what, that wasn't quite right. I think part of the issue, of course, is always doing science by news conference, and so there was a lot of publicity. They released their, you know, preliminary results. They hadn't been peer-reviewed yet. And it generated a lot of buzz. They tried to be very cautious, you know, all sorts of caveats in their presentation. But in the end, you know, it looks like it was most likely wrong. I mean, it's not 100% sure, but that's the current thinking. And so it's just always that issue of how soon should you announce your results if they've not even been peer-reviewed, for example.
Yeah. Well, we never know what's coming at us next. We will be back here in a year to figure out what 2015 has brought. Susan Avery, Michael West, thank you so much for your time and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thanks. Happy New Year.
Susan Avery is President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Michael West is Director of Astronomy at the Mariah Mitchell Association on Nantucket. Remember, you can find more on the year's top scientific advances on our website, capeandislands.org. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening and Happy New Year.